Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now in Ezekiel chapter 32, which I will entitle A Lament Over Pharaoh and Egypt. We start in verse 1. In the 12th year, in the 12th month, on the first day, the word of the Lord came to me, Ezekiel. The 12th year is in the 12th year since Ezekiel's 597 exile to Babylon. 597 minus 12 is 585 about, which means that Jerusalem has just fallen in the previous years. This prophecy has been given about a year later than the last prophecy in Ezekiel 31, or at least the first prophecy in Ezekiel 31. In verse 1, in that chapter we read, in the 11th year prophecy was given. So we're moving along. So we're about 585. In the 12th year, the 12th month, on the first day, the 12th month is Adar, February and March. On Adar the first, the word of the Lord came to Ezekiel, son of man. Now, why does God call Ezekiel son of man? A couple of theories on that. One is that son of man means that Ezekiel takes on the characteristics of a man, and the characteristics of a man are not good, fallible, devious, sneaky. And so God is trying to keep Ezekiel humble. The other theory is that God is making a type of Ezekiel, a type for the antitype, Jesus, who also called himself the Son of Man. He did that all the way through the Gospels. He got the phrase from Daniel 7:14, the Son of Man went up to the Ancient of Days. So that phrase obviously referred to the Messiah, as the people in the Old Testament understood it. And so Jesus deliberately took that title for himself, called himself the Son of Man. And Ezekiel makes a good type of the Son of Man, because Ezekiel was preaching against the rebellious house of Israel, and he predicted the burning of its temple, which happened in 586 BC by the Babylonians. Jesus, as the antitype, also preached against the rebellious house of Israel and also predicted the burning and destruction of the temple of Jerusalem in AD 70 by the Romans. So, going back to Ezekiel 32, verse 2, God tells Ezekiel, Son of man, take up a lament concerning Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him. Now, who is this Pharaoh? This is Pharaoh Hophra. The Greeks knew him as Apries. Apries. A-P-R-I-E-S. He ruled from 589 to 570. Now, remember, we're in 585, so Pharaoh Hophra is still in power right now. So God tells Ezekiel to take up a lament concerning Hophra and say to him, you are like a lion among the nations. You are like a monster in the seas. It's probably a crocodile, because crocodiles are the typical monster that you see in Egypt. You are like a crocodile, let's say, in the seas, thrashing about in your streams. Well, I don't know what seas means. That sounds like the Mediterranean Sea, but it could be just the Nile River. The crocodiles thrashing about in the streams that intersect the Nile, churning the water with your feet and muddying the streams, as crocodiles would do. This is what the Sovereign Lord says, with a great throng of people I will cast my net over you. That throng of people, of course, is referring to the Babylonians. Ezekiel 29 through 31, those three chapters assume that Babylonians attacked Egypt. In fact, they specifically say that the Babylonians attacked Egypt. Now, there's no secular record of this, although there is secular record of Babylon attacking Egypt in 568, but it's not strong evidence, and the results are not recorded as being catastrophic for the Egyptians. However, I assume Ezekiel's prophecy is true. The truth of a prophecy does not depend on outside corroboration. Secular history often relies on serendipity. Did somebody find the proper clay tablets that recorded the event, or did they not? So this great throng of people coming upon Pharaoh the crocodile is the people of Babylonia. I will cast my net over you, God tells Hophra, and they will haul you up in my net. I will throw you on the land and hurl you on the open field. If you'll think about a crocodile being tossed on the land into a field as he's pulled out of the water. I will let all the birds of the air settle on you, and all the beasts of the earth gorge themselves on you. I would assume this is a dead crocodile now. A bird or a beast is not going to attack a living crocodile. Now, this could refer literally to birds and beasts eating the corpse of Hophra as he's thrown on the ground, but I don't think so. There's no historical evidence of that happening. In fact, there's a split of opinion amongst the ancient sources about how Hophra died. Some say he died in battle in 570, and some say that he was restored to some kind of political dignity, and then the people said, no, get rid of him. And so the next Pharaoh did him in. But it doesn't matter. The symbolism is clear. Egypt is going to die. Egypt, symbolized by that beached crocodile, Egypt is going to die. The birds and the beast, I think, are merely a poetic reference to what happened to that beached crocodile. In other words, the birds and the beast are not literal here, but they're part of the metaphor. Verse 5, God continues speaking to Hophra, I will spread your flesh on the mountains and fill the valleys with your remains. That means the crocodile has got to be ripped up in order for its flesh to be spread around on the mountains and in order for its flesh to fill the valleys. Verse 6, God says, I will drench the land with your flowing blood all the way to the mountains. This is an exaggeration, of course. You have to be a big crocodile to do that, actually. And the ravines will be filled with your flesh. Great rhetoric here. Ezekiel 32, verses 7 through 10, God continues, when I snuff you out, when I, Yahweh, snuff you, Hophra, out, I will cover the heavens and darken their stars. Now, let's see what darken their stars might mean. Option number one, this could refer to the smoke coming from the snuffed candle, which is mentioned in verse 7, when I snuff you out. You snuff a candle out, smoke comes up, and the smoke comes up, covers the sky, and darkens the stars. I think most probably option number two is correct. It refers to decreation rhetoric, that typical type of rhetoric that is used to show the dissolution of kingdoms and states, just like Jesus used in the Olivet Discourse, just like Isaiah used if it's everywhere in the Old Testament prophets. The stars fall from the sky like figs from a tree. The sky is rolled up like a garment. The moon turns to blood. The sun turns black like sackcloth. Whenever you see that rhetoric, that means some nation or empire is getting judged by God. Option number three about this darkness, this is a reference to Egypt being darkened during the 10 plagues at the time of Moses. Well, I don't think so, because this is a prophecy, and Moses is before Ezekiel's time by a good bit. I think this is your typical decreation rhetoric. Egypt, you're going down, which actually happened. Hophra died in 570. The Persians under Cambyses took over in 525, and Egypt ever since then was ruled by foreign powers, and its empire never came back. God continues in verse 7, I will cover the sun with a cloud, and the moon will not give its light. There's your decreation rhetoric. All the shining lights in the heavens I will darken over you. Again, some more decreation rhetoric. I will bring darkness over your land, declares the sovereign Lord. Darkness is usually not a happy time. People get robbed in the darkness. People get mugged in the darkness. It's a typical symbol for the opposite of sunlight. If your mind is dark, that means you're not seeing things. I will bring darkness over your land, declares the sovereign Lord. And again, God calls himself the sovereign Lord like he does all the way through the book of Ezekiel, which means he's in charge of history. He can judge big shot emperors anytime he wants to. Verse 9, I will trouble the hearts of many peoples when I bring about your destruction among the nations, among lands you have not known. So verse 9 tells us that Hophra will be destroyed. Let's read about his demise in Wikipedia. Apries, remember Apries is the Greek name for Hophra, attempted to protect Libya from incursion by Dorian Greek invaders, but his efforts backfired spectacularly. This is somewhere near the end of his reign in 570. His efforts backfired spectacularly as his forces were mauled by the Greek invaders. When the defeated army returned home, a civil war broke out in the Egyptian army between the indigenous troops and the foreign mercenaries. The Egyptians threw their support to Amasis II, a general who had led Egyptian forces in a highly successful invasion of Nubia in 592 under Pharaoh Psamtik II, Apries' father. Amasis quickly declared himself pharaoh in 570 BC, and Apries fled Egypt, as Hophra fled Egypt and sought refuge in a foreign country. When Apries, also known as Hophra, marched back to Egypt in 567 BC with the aid of a Babylonian army to reclaim the throne of Egypt, he was likely killed in battle with Amasis' forces. Alternatively, Herodotus holds that Apries, also known as Hophra, survived the battle and was captured and treated well by the victorious Amasis, until the Egyptian people demanded justice against him, against Hophra, whereby Hophra was placed into their hands and strangled to death. Amasis thus secured his kingship over Egypt and was then its unchallenged ruler. So in verse 9, God says, Hophra, you're going to be destroyed, and that's what happened. Now this phrase here, I will bring about your destruction among the nations. What does that mean? Among lands you have not known. Let's look at some options as to what happened in lands not known. Option number 1, Hophra was defeated in a foreign land. He was defeated in Libya to the west of Egypt by the Greeks in the aforesaid battle in which he was whipped badly, and as a result thereof had a civil war break out amongst his troops, and Hophra was exiled out of the country. That's option number 1. Option number 2 as to what happened in lands not known was grief over Hophra's fate by the Egyptian exiles. And these exiles tell of that grief to their new countries. So we would read the verse this way, I will trouble the hearts of many peoples. That would be the exiles. Now what exiles they are, I don't know. But these exiles are said, according to this option, to go out among the nations. So verse 9, I will trouble the hearts of many peoples when I bring about your destruction among the nations. In other words, when I bring news of your destruction among the nations. Benson says, in support of this option, when thy exiles shall be dispersed into foreign countries and relate the miserable circumstances of thy destruction, Hophra, it shall cause grief and consternation in all that hear it. Against that view is Cambridge. The Cambridge commentator says, this hardly means bring the news of thy destruction. The destruction itself occurs among the nations. Now, Cambridge doesn't mention when that happened, but that view would fit the idea of option number 1, that Hophra was defeated among the nations by the Greeks in Libya. Here's option number 3. Hophra is exiled after his defeat in Libya. Let me go back and read you from Wikipedia. After he lost the battle, quote, Apries fled Egypt and sought refuge in a foreign country. And then he came back with a Babylonian army. I don't know what foreign country he sought refuge in, but it was obviously near the Babylonian Empire, within the Babylonian Empire, and the Babylonians tried to help him get his throne back. And so we would read verse 9 this way, I will trouble the hearts of many peoples when I bring about your destruction, Hophra, among the nations, because you went among the nations to get help, but the Babylonians came back and got beat. I'm not sure which of those options is the best, so I'll report that one and let you decide. We move now to Ezekiel 32, verses 11 through 16. For this is what the Sovereign Lord says, the sword of the king of Babylon will come against you. I will cause your hordes to fall by the swords of mighty men, the most ruthless of all nations. And of course, that's the Babylonian Empire that's called the most ruthless of all nations. They will shatter the pride of Egypt, and all her hordes will be overthrown. All the hordes of Egypt. Egypt had a lot of population then. I will destroy all her cattle from beside abundant waters, no longer to be stirred by the foot of man or muddied by the hoofs of cattle. Now that word cattle is sometimes translated as beast, as in the Young's Literal Translation and the American Standard Version. And because it can be translated as beast, some have said this is referring to horses, which Egypt was famous for and abounded with. And those horses, of course, would be good booty for the Babylonians. Or it could just refer to cattle and sheep, or oxen and sheep. Modern translations have cattle. I will destroy all her cattle. NIV, Home of Christian Study Bible, has cattle. But it doesn't matter. The point is that Egypt is going to lose a lot of material wealth. Her waters, those canals dug into the Nile River, they're no longer going to be stirred by men or cattle walking through the water, because there will be no cattle to walk through the water. Verse 14, then I will let her waters settle and make her streams flow like oil. Well, what does it mean that Egypt's waters will settle? We have a translation issue here. The Young's Literal Translation has, then do I cause their waters to sink, and their rivers as oil I cause to go. Well, sink is close to settle, as the NIV has. The American Standard Version has, then I will make their waters clear and cause their rivers to run like oil. Their waters will be clear because the cattle will be gone and no longer muddy the waters. The Bible in Basic English says, then I will make their waters clear and their rivers flowing like oil. And likewise, the Darby translation says, then I will make their waters clear. Now, the Darby note says, the word there, the Hebrew word, means literally settle or sink down. So clear is a translator's interpretation of settle. The waters will settle or sink down. And if you think about it, sediment in water, as it sinks down, or as it settles, it makes the water clear, so the two ideas are close. Now, that could just refer to the fact that there's no cattle there, but it also could refer to the fact that the waters of the Nile will recede by the hand of God, and when that happens, the waters don't flow very well. And that's why I think that's what it means, because the settling of the water makes the Nile streams flow like oil. Now, those streams could be all of the little rivers that flow into the Nile, or it could be canals dug into the Nile, but they're not going to flow because oil flows very slowly. And just because the waters clear up because the cows aren't walking in it anymore, that doesn't really make the streams flow like oil. So I like the translation, settle. The waters are going to sink. They're going to recede because God's not going to let the Nile flow as it usually does. Her streams will flow like oil. Options there include this. Option one, the streams would move slowly because oil moves slowly, as if the streams were in mourning. Option number two, the streams will move quietly, symbolizing the fact that there's no more political activity for Egypt. Egypt has died. Either one of those fits pretty good. Mourning for a country that's died. Verse 15, when I make Egypt desolate and strip the land of everything in it, when I strike down all who live there, then they will know that I am the Lord. Now, that phrase, they will know that I am the Lord, occurs lots and lots of times in these last several chapters, because sometimes the only way God can make people know who he is he has to judge them, because mankind is so incredibly arrogant and rebellious against the God who made us. Verse 16, this is the lament they will chant for her. What lament? Well, that's the lament that was mentioned all the way back up in verse 2. Ezekiel said in chapter 32, verse 2, son of man, lament for Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and say to him. So this is a funeral dirge. That's what lament means. The daughters of the nations will chant it. Daughters, of course, means the populations of the nations. That's a common metaphor. They will chant this funeral dirge for Egypt and all her hordes. They will chant it, declares the sovereign Lord. We go down to Ezekiel 32, verses 17 through 23. In the 12th year, on the 15th day of the month, the word of the Lord came to me. Now, the first 16 verses were given in the 12th year, in the 12th month, Adar, on the first day of the month. The month is not mentioned here in verse 17, but the 15th day of the month, I assume, and I'm sure this is true, that Ezekiel is assuming the same month of Adar. So in verse 17, in the 12th year, on the 15th day of the month Adar, Adar, you remember, is January, February, 15th day in verse 17, verse 1, it's the first day, so we're talking 14 days later. Another prophecy comes to Ezekiel. Verse 18, son of man, wail for the hordes of Egypt and consign to the earth below both her and the daughters of mighty nations. Now Ezekiel's going to talk about the people of Egypt dying and going to Hades, going to the land of the dead, going to the grave. Consigned to the earth below both her and the daughters of many nations. In other words, not just Egypt's going to Hades, but also the populations, the daughters of many other nations. And a few will be mentioned as we go through. So Egypt will be consigned with other nations, with those who go down to the pit. That's the grave, of course, as John Gill says of this grave. Not unto stately sepulchres built on high, such as were made for the kings of Egypt, but unto common pits or graves, dug in the lower parts of the earth, where the meaner and common sort of people were buried. Verse 19, say to them, are you more favored than others? Are you Egyptians more favored than others? No, because all of you are going to end up in Hades, and you're going to be equal down there. Go down and be laid among the uncircumcised. Now, of course, the Egyptians looked down on uncircumcised people because they themselves used circumcision, just like the Jews did. And so the uncircumcised would be considered barbarians, but the Egyptians are going to be buried with those barbarians. Verse 20, they, that's the Egyptians, will fall among those killed by the sword. The sword is drawn. Let her be dragged off with all her hordes. Egypt is going to be dragged off with all her hordes. Verse 21, from within the grave the mighty leaders will say of Egypt and her allies, that's the mighty leaders of Egypt, they have come down and they lie with the uncircumcised, with those killed by the sword. Allies are mentioned too. Remember, Egypt had a bunch of mercenaries. Remember, Hophra had a bunch of mercenaries in the Egyptian army. They have come down and they lie with the uncircumcised, with those killed by the sword. Assyria is there with her whole army. She is surrounded by the graves of all her slain, all who have fallen by the sword. In other words, Assyria killed a bunch of people, and they certainly did because they were the big bad boys of the ancient Near East. They've already been destroyed now. The last remnants of their army were destroyed in 605 BC by Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon. So they're down there in Hades waiting for Hophra. Their graves are in the depths of the pit, and her army lies around her grave. The Assyrians' army does that. All who would spread terror in the land of the living are slain. That's Assyria. They had done that. They terrorized everybody. They weren't as merciful as the Persians when they captured a province. So all the Assyrians are lying there, fallen by the sword. Now God is going to turn his attention to another nation that is lying down in the pit. Elam, verse 24. Elam is there with all her hordes around her grave. All of them are slain, fallen by the sword. All who had spread terror in the land of the living went down uncircumcised to the earth below. They bear their shame with those who go down to the pit. A bed is made for her among the slain with all her hordes around her grave. All of them are uncircumcised, killed by the sword. Because their terror had spread in the land of the living, they bear their shame with those who go down to the pit. They are laid among the slain. Now, Elam is a very famous ancient Near Eastern nation. It's located at the southwestern extremity of the Persian Empire. But Elam was a country long before the Persian Empire. When you read ancient Near Eastern history, you will read all about Elam. My dates are fuzzy. 2000 BC, 1500 BC, maybe even 2500 BC. I can't remember, but Elam is very prominent, but they're dead now. Elam actually also was an independent kingdom at the time of Abraham. Abraham, of course, is around 1951 is his birth date. I like that because that's the same year I was born in A.D. I've seen that date given as to when he was born. And when Abraham was grown up and moved into the kingdom of Israel, he saw his nephew Lot kidnapped by a confederation of Mesopotamian city-states, one of which was Elam. You remember that famous story? Abraham went out, rescued his nephew Lot. Abraham took a tenth of the spoils of the war, gave them to Melchizedek, the king of Jerusalem, or Salem, as it was called then. Famous story. Well, Elam was involved in that. That's in Genesis 14. Next, as God talks about the other nations that are down there in Hades, verse 26, Meshach and Tubal are there. Meshach and Tubal are there with all their hordes around their graves. All of them are uncircumcised, killed by the sword because they spread their terror in the land of the living. Do they not lie with the other uncircumcised warriors who have fallen, who went down to the grave with their weapons of war? It's interesting how Ezekiel, or Yahweh through Ezekiel, makes a big point about the nations lying uncircumcised down there. That must have really been an affront to the Egyptians. Now, where is Meshach and Tubal? Meshach is right dead in the center of the Anatolian province, present-day Turkey. I've got a map here from BibleAtlas.org. It's got it circled quite nicely. It's almost as if somebody was taking a pie cutter and cutting out the center of present-day Turkey. I've also got a map of Tubal. Tubal is right to the north of Meshach along the southern Black Sea coast. It's also called Pontus in BibleAtlas.org. And it covers Bithynia to the west. It's basically the strip of modern-day Turkey, which lies on the southern Black Sea coast. So when you put the two together, and they're often mentioned together in the scriptures, Meshach and Tubal, basically talking about Anatolia, Turkey. John Gill calls the people of Meshach and Tubal Scythians. I've decided that when somebody doesn't know who somebody is, call them a Scythian. That'll work. Scythians typically came from southern Russia. I've seen Tubal as mentioned being in present-day Georgia and Azerbaijan between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea. I don't know about that, but you're getting up there toward the south of Russia where the Scythians came. That's what the Romans called them, the Scythians. But we won't worry about that. And by the way, these are not the names of modern nations involved in eschatology. People just assume that. I grew up on that stuff. I reject that stuff. It's talking about people that were living during the time of Ezekiel. I say living. Actually, they used to be living there in the grave now. Now, in verse 27, the people, the dead soldiers of Meshach and Tubal, are said to have swords placed under their heads. Now, what does that mean? Two options. Option number one, this is gotten from looking at carvings on graves and monuments. The soldiers would lie down sleeping with the sword under their head, and that would show that no man had beaten them with the sword. So they voluntarily laid down on their sword as a pillow. Nobody had taken their sword in battle, and they were sleeping peacefully on their sword. I don't think so. That's too positive. This is a negative reference. So option number two as to what this phrase means, the sword of the people of Meshach and Tubal, their swords were under their heads, means, according to option number two, that their swords were literally placed under their heads in the grave. As Gill, Clark, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown all say, it was common in the ancient world to place swords and other military equipment in the graves of military men. And Albert Barnes says, the custom of burying warriors with their swords, shields, or helmets under their heads is well known and common to most warlike nations. The end of verse 27 says, the punishment for their sins, that's Meshach and Tubal, the punishment for their sins rested on their bones, though the terror of these warriors had stalked through the land of the living. So there's sort of a formula here. They're uncircumcised, they terrorized the people in the land of the living, and they got killed by the sword, and they got thrown down to the pit. We go now to Ezekiel 32, verses 28 through 32, and we will finish this audio. You too, O Pharaoh, this is God speaking to Pharaoh, Hophra, you too, O Pharaoh, will be broken and will lie among the uncircumcised with those killed by the sword. The reason God's mentioning all these other countries like Meshach, Tubal, Elam, and Assyria is he's basically saying you're going to have company. These people are already dead and you're going to join them. So it's a literary device. So verse 28, you too, O Pharaoh, will be broken and will lie among the uncircumcised with those killed by the sword. Edom is there. Oh, we got another kingdom there, Edom, which of course is that nation south of Israel in the desert of Arabia Petraea, south of the Dead Sea, crossing the Araba Valley, which is south of the Dead Sea, going from east to west. Edom is there, her kings and all her princes, despite their power, they are laid with those killed by the sword. Of course, Edom's ancestor was Esau, of Jacob and Esau fame. They lie with the uncircumcised, with those who go down to the pit. Verse 30, all the princes of the north and all the Sidonians are there. So we've got some more people down there to keep Egypt company. The Sidonians were there because they had many conquerors. This is from Wikipedia. Sidon had many conquerors, Assyrians, Babylonians, Egyptians, Persians, Greeks, and finally Romans. Now, who were the princes of the north who were said to be there also? Well, John Gill says that could refer to Babylon, Damascus, or Tyre. Clark says it could be Media, or northern Persia, or Assyria. And Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says it could be Syria, not Assyria, but Syria, or the Tyrians, the people of Tyre. Of course, there's lots of options there from the north of nations or peoples who had been uprooted, killed, and tossed down into Hades. So in verse 30, all the princes of the north and all the Sidonians are there. They went down with the slain in disgrace, despite the terror caused by their power. They lie uncircumcised, there's that word again, with those killed by the sword and bear their shame with those who go down to the pit. Verse 31, Pharaoh, he and all his army will see them and he will be consoled. He will be consoled for all his hordes that were killed by the sword. Why would he be consoled? Well, that's because misery loves company. Hophra will be glad to see he wasn't the only great monarch to be thrown into the pit. And so he will be consoled for all the hordes that were killed by the sword, all of his Egyptian soldiers and people killed by the sword. Again, this is assuming Babylon is coming in and wiping out the people of Egypt. Verse 32, although I had him spread terror in the land of the living, Pharaoh and all his hordes will be laid among the uncircumcised, with those killed by the sword, declares the sovereign Lord. So in other words, there's a big pile of uncircumcised dead corpses in Hades, Hophra, and you're going there. It is a terrible thing to fall into the hands of the living God, as the author of the book of Hebrews said. And on that somber note, we have now finished Ezekiel chapter 32, and we are prepared in our next audio to go to Ezekiel 33, which I will entitle, Ezekiel is Israel's Watchtower. I hope you stay tuned for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.